to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
IRN USA Radio News, I'm Hope Duggar. The ousted head of the Internal Revenue Service apologized to Congress Friday for...
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here do not necessarily reflect those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Jim Fetzer. And Jim is one of my favorite liberals. He's a brilliant individual, and although we might agree with some of the disagree on the solutions, we see the same problems, and he sees it very, very clearly. So he's one of the most articulate people we have out there, talking about the things that we talk about. And, of course, Jim is going to be attending. He's going to be a speaker at the Conspiracy Conference held in Milpitas, that's just north of Santa Clara, on the 1st and 2nd of June. That's the Conspiracy Conference, and I'm going to be there. I'm not going to be a speaker. I'm going to have a booth. But we certainly want people to know people are going to be speaking, and Jim will be one of the better speakers there. Hi, Jim. How are we doing?
Oh, Stan, it's great to be back with you again. I'm just so delighted, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in Milpitas so very soon.
I am as well. Well, what are we going to talk about tonight? Do you want to talk about the Boston Marathon bombing? Because
Basically
they have not told us the truth about that, and we're reading all of these extensive things in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal about this young man who went over to Chesney and how he was radicalized, or he was trying to, in fact, he was so radical that the people over there didn't want to have anything to do with him. But nobody has ever asked, where did he get the money? I mean, how was he able to travel over there and stay for 6 months and with no source of income? He'd not had a job in the United States. He was a student. He was married. His wife and child were over here. And yet, of course, he was able to go over there at 23 years of age and stay there for 6 months and travel all over that area. Talks old case a lot of money to do something like that. And nobody has ever asked, where did the money come from? But you pick up the story. I'd like to know what your take is on what's going on.
Well, Stan, I think you're absolutely right. I think when it's all said and done, it'll turn out that he was being manipulated by intelligence agents, many of whom were affiliated with the CIA, setting him up as a patsy, very much as Lee Oswald was surrounded by intelligence agents who were setting him up to be a patsy. I think the parallels are going to turn out to be rather strong, just as the younger brother was even alleged to have shot the security guard. The truth of the matter, Stan, appears to be that knowing he was wanted, he wanted to turn himself into somebody he trusted. He knew the security guard. He trusted him. So he gave himself up to the security guard, who called in to the officials to tell him he had him in custody, and they came out and apparently shot him in the face. They didn't want him to be around. The younger brother got away, hid in this boat and all that. Then apparently, when they didn't kill him by riddling that boat with bullets, I don't know, it must have been in excess of 100 rounds, he was able to get himself out of the boat on his own, of his own accord, his own ability. And I think rather shortly thereafter, his throat was slit by someone who wanted to make sure he couldn't talk. Now, there's an irony to all of this, which is that he's a college student. He's got manual dexterity. He's used to tweeting and using computers. What do we think? This guy couldn't write about what his experiences were, but it seems very clear that the whole chain of confessions he was alleged to have given were literally words put in his mouth, and he didn't say any of those things. He seems to be a perfectly decent young man. He was a wrestler. He was in college. He was in the drama club. He was engaged with his buddies. He went back to hang with them after the event. The backpack he was wearing was slung over his right shoulder. It didn't appear to be carrying any kind of pressure cooker. It was a different color than the backpacks that exploded. His was a silver. One of them was a black backpack with a white square that was one from one of the Kraft International perps who actually pulled this off, and where the alternative media cracked the case so fast that the FBI had to send out a stooge to tell the world not to look at the man behind the curtain, only look at these two photographs of the two brothers. Instead, would you believe they asked? They actually appealed for the public's help in identifying the two brothers when it turns out they'd had them under surveillance already for at least 5 years. They knew perfectly well who it was they were showing photographs of. This is just completely outrageous and betrays the level of corruption, the depth of corruption of our Department of Justice and our FBI.
Well, I think that basically all you had to do was look at the pictures of the backpacks, and you could tell if you looked at those pictures, there certainly weren't room in them for these pressure cookers. And basically, but nobody ever questions. I mean, how could you put a pressure cooker in that backpack? There just wasn't room there. But, of course, they repeat things over and over again, and an awful lot of people will believe, but I really believe, Jim, that there's going to be more and more people questioning what they really saw and what really happened.
Well, this was the most amateurish false flag attack I've ever seen, had anything to do with, and I've been paying attention to quite a few. And it even includes, you know, that you had all these Kraft International people around. They had these black jackets. They had these black backpacks. They were wearing khaki trousers and pretty much khaki-colored shoes. They had these very distinctive caps that had a skull insignia for Kraft, which has the motto, violence does solve problems. Damn, violence does solve problems. And we have plenty of pictures of them around. They're on cell phones. They're talking to one another. They're not paying attention to the marathon. One of them has this distinctive backpack that has this white square insignia on it. And after the explosion, he's seen running away, and he no longer has his backpack. And the bag that has exploded has that distinctive white square. If anyone would like to see a late version of it, I've got, four articles about the Boston bombing on Veterans Today. One of them is titled Man of the Year, Stella Trembe, New Hampshire Legislator. And that's not a mistake when I nominate her for Man of the Year rather than Woman of the Year or Person of the Year, Stan, because she's the only one out there who's had the balls to tell it like it is.
And who is that now?
Stella Trembe. She's a woman, a member of the legislature in New Hampshire. And believe it or not, the New Hampshire legislator has just voted 312-1 to honor this guy, Jeff Bauman, who's alleged to have lost his legs. The whole thing is a complete charade, Stan. He didn't lose his legs. It was a phony. The blood was phony. You can see him lying there. There's got an assistant who's wearing a hood who's helping to put a false prosthesis on his leg to look at though he's got a bone extension. But when you do a fine tuning on the bone extension, it doesn't even look like the tibia it's supposed to be. He doesn't have
hold that thought. Burn. Hold that thought, Jim. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Jim Fetzer. And certainly Jim is talking about the fact that apparently it was the New Hampshire legislature voted, almost unanimously, only one vote against it, to honor this fellow, Jeff Bauman, who lost both legs and certainly at the bombing. And ladies and gentlemen, if you really want to know what happened, certainly you can go up on the internet and you can actually type in Jeff Bauman, Bauman, and certainly a wheelchair or something like that. And you'll see pictures, they're up there, I hope they haven't taken them all down yet, but of this gentleman, he's sitting in a wheelchair. He's lost his right leg. You can see some blood and a little bit of flesh there. On the left side, the leg is elevated, so you can see it. Actually, there's a fellow with a cowboy hat. And he's got a tourniquet around the left leg, only it's not tightened down. It's the tourniquet's just being used to boost it up in the air, but it's not tightened down to stop the excessive loss of blood. Now, I'm, as you know, I was a surgeon for many years. I took care of a lot of trauma. If you lose one leg, and certainly you'll bleed to death very shortly if you don't have a tourniquet on, this man lost both legs. He lost both legs. We know because the legs aren't there. Oh, there's a BK amputation on the left side, the one with a tourniquet on it. There's an AK amputation on the right side. And this fellow's sitting in a wheelchair. Certainly, you look at the left leg. It's a well-healed below-the-knee amputation stump. I've taken care of a lot of them. I've produced many of them. This is a long time below-the-knee amputation stump with a piece of bone sticking out of the end. Doesn't look much like a tibia. There's no flesh. There's not one a bruise or abrasion in the well-healed below-knee amputation stump. It's just sitting there with this piece of bone. There's certainly no evidence of anything there. There's not even any blood on the left side other than the blood on the tibia. And when you first see it, you say, horrible. And then you stop and think about it. And it's obvious that it's a staged film. And then, of course, certainly I've called the rehab hospital personally, repeatedly, introduced myself as being from the media, tried to talk to the gentleman in charge at the Spalding Rehab Hospital, in charge of public relations. And he always says in the recording, if you have to meet a deadline, call me on my cell phone, which you do repeatedly. He'll never call back again. And, of course, you have to ask yourself, is this really true? Well, 19 days after the bombing, with this young man lost both legs, is discharged from the rehab hospital. And we see him at the Boston Bruins hockey game, waving a flag with a big smile on his face, and he has two above-knee amputations. Now, remember, he had a below-knee amputation on the initial film, and yet now he has two above-knee amputations, and the biggest smile you ever saw. I wonder how many of you who have lost both legs would be able to sit and attend a hockey team and wave the flag with a big smile on your face just 19 days. Not only that, he's discharged from the rehab hospital. That's the most amazing recovery in all time, either that or this whole thing is a fraud. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, Stan, it's so wonderful to have your medical expertise applied to this case because the whole thing is indeed a fraud, as you're observing. Blood is not spurting out of this just immediately amputated leg, and it only shows up later. It's fake blood. It would have come out bright red, but it's still bright red later. It would have oxidized. It would have turned to dark red. We're looking at Hollywood special effects at work here. And when they're rushing him away in a wheelchair, Stan, they somehow jiggle the fake prosthesis loose. It falls off. They have to stop the wheelchair and reattach it. This is embarrassingly bad.
Now, did you actually have a picture of that when the prosthesis falls off?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. That's in the article entitled Man of the Year, Stella Tremblay, New Hampshire Legislator. You can see the three frames from the photo sequence. The whole sequence is online. When they're rushing him off with a wheelchair. I've heard reports, Stan, I haven't confirmed yet, that they ran him off in the wheelchair several times. In other words, they were doing several takes of it as Hollywood-style, filming. But I haven't been able to confirm that. I do know that I have the one film frames from the one sequence in which it falls off and they have to reattach it. Very embarrassing. And you can find that in that article.
All right, find out, would you tell our listeners how they can get to your website and get your information?
Absolutely. You can do a search on Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer. Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer. Just do a Google search. It'll bring you to my archive. And I have four articles now on the Boston bombing. One is entitled Some Hard Lessons from the Boston Bombing. One is entitled Welcome to America with a K, No More Truth, Justice, or American Way. Then there's the third one, Man of the Year, Stella Tremblay, New Hampshire Legislator. And most recently, Stan, Boston Bombing, New Hampshire versus Jim Fetzer. Because when I discovered that the legislature had not only voted massively to honor this fraud, Jeff Bauman, but also to condemn Stella Tremblay, to me that was too much. So I began posting comments, and there's been an extremely interesting exchange I've had with, readers of the union leader. So I think that is a particularly valuable exercise to see how they have been responding to the points I've been making, the evidence I've been producing, and how much they are in denial, Stan. I'm simply dumbfounded. by the extent to which the American public is taken in, where they have mistaken authority for truth. In other words, if there's an official is claiming something is the case, they're accepting that rather than looking at the evidence and thinking for themselves.
But, Jim, I understand how people feel. I mean, it took me 2 years after the bombing of the Twin Tower to realize that that was a controlled demolition. I didn't want to believe that they'd killed almost 3,000 Americans that day. In fact, they really wanted to kill 6,000. Oh, but the people in the Morgan Stanley office in the South Tower didn't listen. Basically, the loudspeaker in the offices were telling them, stay in your seats, don't get up, don't worry about what's going on in the North Tower, you're perfectly safe, stay in your seats. And the fellow in charge of security was racing up and down the aisle saying, get out, we're under attack. He got 2,400 people out, otherwise they would have killed them too. In fact, right after the attack, they kept saying, 6,000 people died, 6,000 people died. Well, then it was 5,000, then it was 4,000, then it was less than 3,000. They intended to kill those people too. But, Jim, it's so hard for the average rational mind to face the evil we're up against, that they really wanted to kill those people, and they did kill them in the Twin Towers and in the Pentagon. Of course, there's no way a plane went in an 18-foot hole in the side of the Pentagon, and you put a 757 in that 18-foot hole, and there's no wreckage inside. I talked to a lady who came out through the hole, and there was no wreckage in there. How do you get rid of a 757 and the wings and the motors and all the people and all the fuselage in an 18-foot hole? Well, but basically, if the average individual really can't believe that there's this degree of evil. That's what we're up against.
Oh, Stan, you know what you're talking about. That was April Gallup, of course, who stepped out of that hole and looked around and saw no indication of any plane having hit there. In fact, as you describe it, the hit point is actually about 10 feet high, 16 or 17 feet wide. There's chain link fence. There are two enormous spools of cable. There's a couple of automobiles. There are unbroken windows, but there's no massive pile of debris from a 100-ton airliner, no wings, no bodies, no seats, no luggage, no tail. Stand not even the engines, which are virtually indestructible, recovered from the Pentagon. I mean, the situation is an enormous farce. It's a monster hoax, where the American people were being deceived in order to instill fear into us and convince us we were being under attack by a foreign enemy in order to transform American policy from one in which we never attacked any country that hadn't attacked us first to one in which we launched wars of aggression against Afghanistan, Iraq through NATO, Libya. Now, of course, we're getting involved in Syria, which is calamitous and runs the risk of World War III. But, I mean, this is all just a monster hoax. They passed the Patriot Act without any member of Congress having actually read it. When Patrick Leahy and Tom Daschle wanted to hold hearings, anthrax letters were sent that killed several postal workers. I mean, it was brutal, Stan. It was a sheer power play in order to transform our system of justice and create the Department of Homeland Security, which is now threatening to dominate the entire United States in a military fashion, where part of the reason for the Boston bombing appears to have been to bring in that massive military presence so it would look as though it were something normal and that we should take for granted when it manifestly is not.
Well, I think, you know, the whole TSA at the airports, that we have to go through these long lines, and basically they've never caught one terrorist. What do they do it for? What to impress our minds? This is the battle for the minds of the American people, and that's really what you have to understand, is everything is shaped, and certainly the newspapers are lying to you. It was the Friday after the April 15th Boston Marathon attack, and we were watching Rock Center. And we always watch this on Friday, so this was, 5 days after the attack. And they basically were talking about the shootout that had taken place that evening and how you could actually see they had infrared pictures of it. And they had these two blue blobs up on the screen, and then you see these flashing lights on both sides. Supposedly, the bullets were fired by the brothers, and then the bullets were fired by the police. They told us there were 200 bullets fired by the brothers, you know, And basically then, of course, when the truth came out, they had one gun and hardly any ammunition for it. And all of the videos, if there was any firing at all, it was being done by the police. Then we're told, of course, that the older brother comes out from behind the car, walks towards the police firing. He runs out of ammunition. He's tackled. And then he ends up being beaten to death. And, of course, they can't dispose of his body because nobody wants it. What's the truth? Well, you've already talked about the younger brother. He's lying wounded in a boat. They fire in a 100 rounds of ammunition or something. Again, somebody doesn't even have a weapon. What's really going on, ladies and gentlemen? Stop and think about what's really going on. Jim, go right ahead.
Oh, Stan, you're making some wonderful points. The fact of the matter is they apprehended the older brother. He was stripped naked and put into a police car. Both his aunt and his mother have identified him. It clearly looks like him, even to those of us who aren't close friends or relatives. The next thing we know, his body turns up. It's brutalized. It has a huge incision in the side. His face has been beaten up badly. According to a witness, the police drove over him repeatedly with an SUV. This is completely monstrous and outrageous, Stan. There's no way to avoid the conclusion he was murdered by the police.
Well, of course, we're told that the brother ran over him. The brother jumped in the SUV, and of course, his brother's laying on the ground there, handcuffing him, and he drives right over his brother, and his brother's then dragged for 20 or 30 feet, and then of course, the young man continues driving off, and he's able to get away from the police. That's the amazing thing. He's able to get away, and he parks the car three or four blocks away, and so then they find the car immediately, and then they start... searching all over Boston. They tell people to stay in their houses. They send SWAT teams around. I start to forcing people out of their homes, going in, searching the homes. Why didn't they just search the neighborhood? How far can you go when you're wounded? The car was parked three or four blocks from that. Why isn't it they search that part of Boston? Why did they put the whole of the city under a lockdown? So much of this doesn't make sense. But nobody's asking the logical questions.
You're absolutely right, Stan. It doesn't make any sense unless that was the whole idea, to create a situation of quasi-hysteria that could be exacerbated in the press, and then to have a massive police-military presence. In fact, we even had, subsequent to this, our Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, say that he's ready to toss posse comitatus, which is a statute of the federal government that was passed in 1878 to keep military troops from being used to perform police functions. Then the next thing we know, Mayor of New York City Bloomberg, who most recently disallowed us from drinking big cups of Slurpee, is announcing that he thinks we have to take another look at the Constitution. And in the meanwhile, Stan, there was a huge report about the performance of torture by the Bush administration, by what's known as the Constitution Project, that just happened to get buried in all the news. It would have been the front headline of every newspaper in the country Tuesday morning had it not been for this massive fiasco in Boston. And I'll tell you, the more we're learning, the more phony, the more artificial it becomes, Dan. This whole thing was a charade. And even the 8-year-old boy who is alleged to have been killed appears to have had his face photoshopped into one of those images. He doesn't appear to have been there on the scene. And the whole thing, I'm just telling you, as you were talking about the double amputee who somehow miraculously survived, he's now doing great, and he's going to football games and whatever, and, you know, he's receiving tons of money from people who have been taken in. It's a huge swindle, a huge con, and it looks as though, just as in the case of Sandy Hook, the White House and the Department of Justice in collusion with Homeland Security, in the case of Boston, using Kraft International and the FBI was responsible for this scam. And we have residents of Sandy Hook who are saying how they were rather astonished how that whole morning before the alleged Sandy Hook shooting, there were all these black SUVs with all this high tech equipment extending.
Hold the thought, Tim. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I guess it's Jim Fetzer, and he's retired. You were a professor, weren't you? Where were you? Where did you teach?
Yes, I was, Stan. Quite a few places, Kentucky, Virginia twice, North Carolina at Chapel Hill, a new college at the University of South Florida. I wound up spending the last nearly two decades, 19 years, on the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota. I've had 35 years teaching principally logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. I'm a former Marine Corps officer, Stan. I resigned my commission as a captain at undergraduate school to earn my PhD in the history and the philosophy of science. I published a lot of books, Stan, and a lot of articles. And since my retirement, I've been devoting myself to these matters of public concern because the world can do without another book on the theory of knowledge. But I think it really needs to know the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, even about what's going on in Syria, Stan, not to mention 9/11 and JFK. So I've been devoting myself to all of those. And because I'm a professional scholar by training, when I approach these matters, I do it so in a more rigorous and thoroughgoing fashion than does the average guy in the street, so that there's some benefit that can be derived from my research, which everyone, of course, is entitled to evaluate for themselves.
Well, basically, I think that the important thing for our listeners, if there's so much out there, but let's just look at the Marathon bombing. Let's look at the personality of Jeff Bauman. Who is Jeff Bauman? Well, you can certainly find his name up on the Internet and look at the pictures of him there, the initial pictures with the left BK below the knee amputation and the tibia sticking out. That's his stage picture. And basically, because, of course, now we see him, pictures of him is sitting at the Boston Bruin hockey game, and he's waving a flag with a big smile on his face 19 days after losing both legs. And now he's a left-sided above the amputation, bilateral above the amputation. And as I said, we've repeatedly personally called the rehab hospital, and there's no way that we can get in touch with the press officer there. Obviously, somebody is telling him to be quiet. And ladies and gentlemen, when you are in the front lines of this, these disinformation programs, if you speak out, they will kill you. I mean, there's no question. There are over 100 people who are affiliated, knew something about John Kennedy's death, who were simply murdered, and there's books written about all of the dead witnesses. You can get these books up on the Internet. Understand, this is the way the world really works. And certainly I've talked to people in government who told me that they have been threatened. They've actually been threatened with the loss of their jobs, the loss of their pension. They've been threatened with imprisonment and been told they'll spend the rest of their life in Leavenworth if they ever reveal what happened. Because when you go to work for the government, you sign a secrecy agreement, and you must never tell the truth. And listen, we have some wonderful, wonderful books written by John Loftus, who was actually worked at the Justice Department. His job was to track down the Nazis who were responsible for the Holocaust, those in Belarus, Belarus, Russia, and of course he had a security clearance three levels above top secret. But he was told he could not tell the truth. Eventually, the time limitation ran out, and we can find out so much about the Holocaust, the truth about the Holocaust. And of course, you'll find out, of course, in his book, America's Nazi Secret, how those people who killed 2 million Jews, 2 million Jews have been brought to New Jersey and working in government comfortable jobs. And it was all being done by the Justice Department, a different branch of the Justice Department that he lived in. But he was not able to tell this story for 30 years. That's really why we're not getting the story on what really happened at Boston Marathon. Because if you come forward and tell the truth, but you can actually go on the Internet and see the picture of Jeff Bauman sitting in the wheelchair, both legs have been blown off, but it's the strangest looking left leg. Simply a piece of tibia coming out of a well-healed below-knee amputation, BK amputation, on the left side. And how can that possibly be? Because suddenly 19 days later, he has a bilateral above-knee amputation. And, of course, it's obviously it's staged, and Jim Fetzer has the picture of when the prosthesis they put on the left leg fell off. But, of course, you're not going to read about this in a newspaper. Fortunately, we have the Internet. The Internet has given us access to get information out as never before, and you have to get the information. You have to know who you can trust, and then, of course, you've got to help us get that information out across America, because, believe me, freedom fails. Good men rot in filthy jails. If we don't do something to stop. We're moving towards a police state. They want to disarm the American people. They want to convince us there's a war on terrorism, we're a threat from terrorism. Ladies and gentlemen, our southern border is wide open. If there were all these terrorists out there in the, across the world, all they have to do is walk across the border simply with the explosives on their back and go into a mall or a football game or someplace and simply blow up a couple of hundred people at a time. But it hasn't happened. Why? Because the war on terrorism is as phony as a $3 bill. Now, if you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295.
While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so
well, go right ahead, Jim.
Oh, Stan, it's just a delight to listen to you, and the fact that your medical competence has such a role to play here because, as you know, but most Americans do not, an individual suffering with wounds like this would lose a massive quantity of blood in 1 minute. He'd be dead in two. The whole idea here that this was legitimate is simply fantastic if you understand the physiology involved, which you have dissected so beautifully. We also know from Dave Lindorf, who has a website at warisacrime.org, called the Boston police to ask if they had hired the craft personnel who were observed at the scene, and was told by the public affairs officer there that he'd have to call the FBI. So he called the FBI, and he was told by the answer was repeated. That when he went to find out more about it, that he got a public affairs person named Amanda Cox, who said that she didn't have any information on that. He'd been referred to her by the Boston Police Department, and that photos of the scene had shown craft personnel conversing with FBI agents. She then put down the phone and turned to a supervisor, asked, her voice muffled, "This guy's asking about the craft security consultants who hired them and what they were doing." He overheard the muffled voice of another woman to whom she had been speaking reply, "I think you could safely say, I do know we work with a lot of people who work on security at the Marathon. No one, Stan, even wants to acknowledge that craft was there." And, of course, the alternative media was so good at cracking this case right off the bat. I mean, there were hundreds of articles. If you went to Before It's News, for example, it was overwhelming how these guys were spotted and identified as the perps. You see them with their distinctive outfits, and this one guy has a distinctive backpack with a little white square on it. Later, you see that he's rushing off, and he no longer has his backpack. And the very backpack that's exploded is the same one with a little white square. I mean, this is just as outrageous as it gets. And that's why, of course, we had to have an FBI stooge come out and say, "Don't look at that man behind the curtain. Look only at the photographs we want you to look at." And so they have surveyed every photograph of every individual.
Hold the thought. We'll be right back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Jim Fetzer, and Jim's a retired professor and certainly a logic, and he's taught certainly for 35 years in major universities, and now he's spending his time trying to educate the American people. Now, basically, Jim, I want you to put your website out. How can people get to your website, get your information?
Well, I think the best place to reach the articles I'm discussing, Stan, is to do a Google search on Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer, and look at my last 8 or 10 articles, and you'll find 4 or 5 about the Boston bombing. If you go back further, you'll find more about Sandy Hook. There's a whole lot about JFK, a whole lot about 9/11, and when I am out there with you at the Conspiracy Con, I'll be talking about what we know now that we didn't know then about the death of our 35th president and the assassination of America.
And there's just no question at all that this was an inside job. I had the opportunity of interviewing Lyndon Johnson's mistress, Madeleine Duncan Brown, and she was at the meeting the night before when they planned this whole thing. She told us exactly who was at the meeting. And after the meeting, Lyndon Johnson had come out of the meeting and came over and whispered in her ear, "Well, after tomorrow, I'm not going to have to worry about that G.D. Kennedy anymore." And, of course, the next day, Kennedy was killed. And here we have interviews with all sorts of people, a fellow the Pentagon liaison to the Special Forces.
Ben, you got it exactly right. I had over 100 conversations with Madeleine Duncan Brown. Right. We had lunch together in Dallas. I interviewed her at a national meeting in 1998. And what you're saying is exactly right. She was attending this meeting. It was actually a ratification meeting at the home of Clint Murchison Sr. the night before the assassination. J. Edgar Hoover was there with his close personal friend Clyde Tolson. Richard Nixon was there. She remembered he was driven out by a local Republican leader who worked in the same bank building where she was a young advertising executive. George Brown of Brown and Root Heavy Construction was there. When the Vietnam War went down, Brown and Root got $1 billion to dredge a new port at Cameron Bay, even though Vietnam has many magnificent natural ports, and I'm quite sure it wasn't needed. John J. McCoy, former High Commissioner to Germany and former Chief Executive Officer at Chase Manhattan Bank, was there. When Lyndon showed up late in the evening, these heavy hitters disappeared into a boardroom, as you described. And when it was over, he strode over to Madeleine, and she thought he was going to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow, he wasn't going to have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys. And 6 weeks later, Stan, during a rendezvous at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, on New Year's Eve, Madeleine confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. He blew up at her and told her the CIA and the oil boys had decided that Jack had to be taken out. What Madeleine has told us has been confirmed by Billy Saul Estes in his book, A Texas Legend, where Billy Saul reports how Lyndon sent Cliff Carter, his chief administrative assistant, down to Texas to make sure that all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. He also knew Malcolm Mack Wallace, who was Lyndon's personal hitman, who killed at least a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters. The story is confirmed by Barr McClellan in his book Blood, Money, Power, when he was working for a very powerful attorney, Ed Clark, who was involved in helping to plan the assassination with Lyndon. It's also been confirmed by E. Howard Hunt in his final confessions, which were published in Rolling Stone, where he told his son, St. John, that the chain of command went from Lyndon to Cord Meyer to David Attlee Phillips to William Harvey to David Sanchez Morales. Even Jack Ruby, Dan, explained to reporters while he was trying to persuade Earl Warren to take him back to Washington that this would never have happened if someone else had been vice president. I mean, it's stunning, Stan, how much we know. And right in the middle, the pivotal player was Lyndon Baines Johnson.
No question at all that he wanted to become the president, and he was in part of the planner for the whole situation, but then so was Richard Nixon. Fascinating interviews, incidentally, we do have that available in a 4-tape set, a 2-hour interview with Madeleine Duncan Brown that Jim is talking about. Well, let's get back, certainly, to the Boston Marathon bombing, because I think it's vitally important. If you're out there, the listening audience, you have a question for Jim. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I suddenly, when you ask yourself, already seen those pictures of Jeff Bauman sitting there in the, he just had both legs blown off. He's had both legs blown off, and he's sitting in a wheelchair. Ladies and gentlemen, he would be in profound shock if he'd had both legs blown off. And there's no tourniquet on the right leg, and suddenly there's the only tourniquet on the left leg is not clamped down, so it wouldn't do any good. It's just being used to raise the leg up so you can see this piece of bone sticking out the end. But there's not a bit of flesh on it. There's no skin, there's no fat, there's no muscle. Just a bare piece of bone with been splattered with some blood. And basically, when you first see that, why, of course, you're shocked and horrified at this terrible thing that's happened. And then, of course, as you stop and think about it as a physician, you realize, where did they get the wheelchair? why was he sitting up? But this patient would be in profound shock. You'd keep him laying down. You'd get him to the hospital. You'd start an IV. You'd transfuse him. You'd have certainly tourniquets on both legs. But they didn't do that. Where did the wheelchair come from? Who put him in the wheelchair? Where are they going? Why aren't they waiting for the ambulances to come? And they're not waiting for the ambulances. They're getting them out where they can get the pictures. And those pictures are plastered all over the internet. And then, of course, ingrained into your mind, ladies and gentlemen out there. What they're doing, of course, is controlling your reality. You think you saw what you saw, but if you stop and think about it, and this is a well-heeled below-the-knee stump. I know I've taken care of them. I've made them myself. I've amputated a lot of knees there, and that is a well-heeled stump, the way that they look after surgery being fashioned so you can put a prosthesis on it. But, of course, that wasn't really his leg. That was a prosthesis itself because he was a bilateral above-knee amputee, and you can see those pictures. You go onto the Internet and type in Jeff Bauman, Boston Bruin hockey game, and a flag, something like that. It's just Boston Bruin hockey game. You'll see the pictures of them with the bilateral above-knee amputations. Ladies and gentlemen, so many of these people were actors. But believe me, if you are an actor in a scenario like this, and you come forward and tell the truth, why, of course, your life isn't, you're going to have a very short life. How many people were injured? I have no idea. How many people were killed? I don't know. Maybe there were three people killed. Maybe there were a couple of hundred people injured. I don't know what happened. But I do know one thing, and that is they're not telling us the truth. And if you can get hold of that, certainly that a program on the Friday evening, Rock Center. And there's a section there where they actually show the infrared pictures of the firing being that evening between, of course, the two brothers and the police. Hundreds and hundreds of shots fired. The only trouble is that the brothers had one gun and only a few rounds of ammunition. It was all phony, ladies and gentlemen. It was all staged. And if once you realize this is all staged, then what are they covering up? Well, let's go to Bruce here, who's calling in from Spokane. Now, do you have a comment at all on that, Jim?
Oh, Stan, I just love being on with you because you know these cases so well. I appreciate everything you've been saying and your medical expertise.
Well, at least I have the advantage from that point of view. I never thought that when I was a surgeon, I'd be preparing myself to become a talk show host.
About a false flag attack by the government.
Right. But anyway, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment for our guest or on this subject, our telephone number is 1-888-1-888-824-LIBERTY or 464-2295. But think of the enormity of what we're talking about. Of course, we can go back certainly 11, 12 years after the attack on the World Trade Center. They killed those people. They murdered them. That was controlled demolition. Those buildings didn't come down because there were fires in them. No building, no steel-reinforced building, has ever come down because of a fire. But those buildings did. And all you need to do is watch Building 7 come down. Typical controlled demolition. The center of the roof caves in first, and then they take out the base of the building, and it collapses symmetrically. And we even have an interview with a man who was in charge of the cleanup for Building 7. He got there the next day, and he told me when I interviewed him, 99% certain that was controlled demolition. I'm not 99% certain. I'm 100% certain it was controlled demolition. Let's go to Bruce calling us from Spokane. Again, our number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-2295. Bruce, you have a question for our guest?
Well, I have a comment.
Go ahead.
To his site. It's a very unique site, and he did a good job documenting this. Very articulate in his documentation, very, you know, systematic in his drawing conclusions. But also, he was he allowed people to comment on this, and this is one of the things that's quite unique in today's society: is the savage ad hominem attacks of people that disagree. They just dripping said savagery. You can see that he retained the comments on his website and then did reply to some. But I've seen this this is a quite common occurrence, something that you and I would never have seen in our earlier days. But this seems to be part of the American society now. I'd forward you some information a couple of weeks ago about how the amputees had been used in training with the military and other services, how they would triage them and dress them up and have them appear to be in this same sort of scenario where they would, you know, they would dress them up and it looking like they had just been just wounded terribly, and then allow that to impact the people working in that scenario, whether it's military, police, fire, etc.
And I got that, and I watched it, and I didn't know it was from you, Bruce, but basically this is simply a video, and it's a training video, and basically they show with how they train people. And these are fellows who are supposedly going into the military, I believe, and under any circumstances, that this is a military exercise, and they have all these actors, and they have amputations. And so they're there, supposedly there's an explosion, and they're there, they're all covered with blood, and they've got these faces are covered with blood, and they've got to pick these people up and take them to the ambulances, and they're moaning and groaning, but they're all actors. They're professional
right.
actors. They're actors who are amputees. And basically, that is the most amazing video. And basically, you can just imagine that this, at least as far as this, Bauman, Jeff Bauman, that's exactly what he was. He is an actor. I don't know what that's his name at all. I know he's collected an awful lot of money. I know he's got an awful lot of play and all the major media. And the fact that he was an actor means that we cannot believe anything we've been told about that, about the Boston Marathon bombing, because it's certainly all of it is contrived. Yes, people may have been injured. We don't know. We don't know anything other than what we read in the newspapers, unless, of course, you start making telephone calls, as I have. And I've made I made a call to the original hospital. I made 3 telephone calls to the rehab hospital. And certainly there is no way that we're going to let us talk to the press people there or try to talk to Jeff Bauman, because I don't think he exists. Anything else you want to say, Bruce?
Well, yes, I think that person that you're going to call Jeff Bauman is going to disappear one way or another, and he's going to have a tragic accident. Furthermore, I thank your guest again for doing such a great documentary and systematically explaining this. I have gone through the same thing. You try to bring people to understand that there is something so horrific out there that people will literally do this to a society. And it's very difficult to try to bring people to that stage of understanding. And you're never the same again once you understand that.
Bruce, it is so hard to face the degree of evil that's out there to accept
that
this could really be true. And I know, because I've had to struggle with this for years. And finally, as I say, it took me almost 2 years before I could finally bring myself to believe that the destruction of the Twin Towers was a controlled demolition. I thought that they knew it had happened, was going to happen. I thought that they allowed it to happen, but that they actually brought those buildings down. I didn't want to believe that.
Well, I didn't either, but it's a progress. It's a progress in your understanding and your philosophy that yes, it does happen. It is. You're just not part of the regular crowd once you understand that.
Jim, how would you respond to what Bruce is saying? Because I think Bruce reflects what an awful lot of people feel. They don't want to believe this.
Yes, yes, yes. It's a phenomenon psychologists refer to as cognitive dissonance, where when you encounter information that clashes with your core beliefs, you suppress it or ignore it or reject it. It's like a woman who discovers indications that her husband's been molesting their daughter. It's so threatening that she suppresses it. When years later the truth emerges and she's asked why she didn't do anything about it, she's at a loss to explain. But what we have to appreciate is our government is unreliable. Our government is lying to us all the time. It's lied to us about JFK.
I agree with that one.
Yeah, it's lied to us about JFK. It's lied to us about 9/11. It lied to us about Sandy Hook. It's lied to us about the Boston bombing. And you have to ask, what's going on here? You know, what has become of our government that is spending more time? The FBI, for example, is committing more crime time arranging for crimes to be committed than it is solving them. It's disgusting.
Well, it's not our government. It's the other government. We have an invisible government. We have an invisible government. and the invisible government simply threatens those in the legitimate government if they dare to tell the truth. Hey, Bruce, we've got to let you go because
okay,
we've got a full
fine.
Board.
Okay, all
God
right,
bless.
Bye.
Thanks for calling. Let's go to Ron calling us from Washington. Hi, Ron. How are we doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Hang on a second.
Oh, Ron's over.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah,
go right ahead, Ron.
Well, any society that kill babies like it does, who could question anything?
Right.
I mean, they can do anything.
Right.
They have no ethics whatsoever.
Right.
And except maybe a power. There's nothing will stand in the way for them to do anything.
Well, I think that we've lost the moral foundation of our society. I would agree with you. Go ahead. Anything else you wanted to say?
Oh yeah. Well, a couple of things. That so it doesn't horrify me. I was at a teacher training and one gal remarked that how come you're so cheerful? I said, well, liberals haven't murdered me today. So any day that liberals don't murder you was a good day.
Well, remember the good liberals out there. I mean, Jim Fetzer is a good liberal.
Hey, you know, be liberal with your own money. That would be my retort.
Basically, don't put all liberals into the same category. A lot of them are.
Well, you know,
I used to be a liberal, so I can understand.
Well, be liberal with. But they said, well, I don't know what. Want to take that? I said, I'm a liberal, so now I'm doubly happy.
Okay, fine. Hey, Ron, I'm going to have to let you go because we're out of time. But anyway,
oh,
God bless you.
Well, I thank you. I thank your guest. That's wonderful information. I'm glad you got people out there doing what he's doing. I commend him. Keep up the good work.
He's one of the most astute people, and I've run into a lot of people. He's a very, very good good researcher, and we're very fortunate to have him. And veterans, is that veterans today?
Yeah. Yeah, Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer will get you to my archive of all my articles, and you'll find, I think, the latest research on all these subjects.
God bless. Thanks very much for calling, Ron.
Yes, sir. Yep.
Well, we've got Jack calling from Michigan. Go ahead, Jack. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, Jim, I read a book. Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie by Pat Shannon. I also wrote a book, The Synagogue of Satan by Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. And in that one, just as in Tex Mars's Conspiracy, The Six-Pointed Star, they identify Israeli entities that control the security systems in this country, the telephone monitoring and billing systems. And Scott DiCarlo, a New Jersey state policeman on 9/11, had arrested a large number of Israeli operatives and dancing Israelis,
Jack, et cetera. Jack, do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, I want to ask him what he thinks about the theory that the Mossad, but that they have this model, by way of deception, thou shalt do war. It almost seems as though the satanic Talmudic serpent Jew leaders believe that they're the superior race and they're going to enslave the world one way or another. And I think what happened at Sandy Hook and then in Boston, again, is evidence of their evil doing.
Okay, fine. Let's get Jim Fetzer's remarks. Jim, what do you think about that?
I wish I could say he were wrong, but in fact, you know, terrorism and the founding of Israel have gone hand in hand. The bombing in 1946 of the King David Hotel was done by Jewish terrorists dressed as Arabs. We have the strafing and torpedoing of the USS Liberty during the 7 Days War to bring the U.S. in on the side, trying to blame it on Egypt. We have the bombing of the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires in 1992 and then of his Jewish community center in 1994 because not enough people were killed. These were jobs done by Israelis on Israeli targets because they wanted to punish Argentina for cooperating with Iran in its development of peaceful nuclear energy. There's a massive evidence that Israel was deeply involved in 9/11. The American neocons who were in the Department of Defense were joint U.S.-Israeli citizens. My very first political speech, Dan, was given at a Ron Paul Freedom Rally on 15 April 2008, where I called for the removal from office of any joint citizen, because how could you know that their loyalty to the United States was not outweighed by their loyalty to the other state? there's a mountain of evidence. There's a, even a
Jim, I'm afraid we're out of time. It's a, but the computer says it's time to go. God bless. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you real soon. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and we had a caller today during the break who wanted to blame everything on the Jews. It's the Jews behind everything. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there are evil Jews, and there are evil Catholics, and there are evil Protestants, and there are evil Scots people. I'm Scots, and there are evil Scots people. But this doesn't mean it's a racial tendency or a religious thing. It means that there are evil people out there. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, let me recommend that you get a copy. Brotherhood of Darkness, I think, will put things into their clear perspective for you so you can begin to understand what really drives the world and who's behind it. If you'd like to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope that you'll want to get some of the other talks we've given. We've got a talk called Agenda 21, The Covert Plan. It will take you into certainly how they are in the process of simply taking away all of our freedom under the name of protecting the environment. But behind that, the powerful spirits of forces aligned against freedom. Then we have a talk called Population Control, the Covert Agenda, and it's really, it really gives you a great overview of what's going on. Now, if you get the Agenda 21, the Covert Plan, it does come with a syllabus, and that syllabus has the writings, not what I say, but what they say, and certainly we include in that so much of what their plan is for the world. And basically, they intend to kill off most of the population of the world, and they're in the process of doing it, and World War III is coming very soon. This is what's really behind everything going on over there in Syria. Israel's attack on Syria, two recent air attacks, was simply ordered by Washington, D.C. Israel does not act independently. Israel is a surrogate of the United States, just as North Korea is a surrogate of Communist China. Incidentally, Communist China, we never refer to it as Communist China, but it is a communist state that was installed back in 1949 by people here in the United States who cut off aid to the nationalist Chinese because we wanted the communists in power. And we financed communism since its inception. You need to get certainly the books by Professor Sutton on Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. And until you understand how this all fits together, none of it makes sense. Let me suggest Dr. Dennis Cuddy's excellent book, The Power Elite and the Secret Nazi Plan. My book, certainly the Brotherhood of Darkness, and certainly if you go to our website of RadioLiberty.com, you'll find all sorts of books there that will help you to better understand what's really going on in the world. There are all sorts of 4-tape sets and 4-CD sets and DVDs. There certainly are the videos. And if you get these and begin watching them, you'll begin to get an education, the education you never got in college. Because remember, I graduated from college, I had a Phi Beta Kappa key, and I was probably one of the least informed people there ever was. I believed everything I'd been taught, and most of it just wasn't true. So you certainly, if you'd like to get information on how they're poisoning certainly our atmosphere and how they're certainly controlling the weather, we actually have some excellent DVDs. One of them is called Geoengineering. One is called Weather Modification. One is called What in the World Are They Spraying? One is called Why in the World Are They Spraying? And they will help you to understand the contrails and the chemtrails and why the level of aluminum is going up in the soil and in the water. Why, for instance, whales, when they biopsy them throughout the world, they find out that the level of aluminum in their blubber has gone up 2,000%. Why? Because they're poisoning us with aluminum. And if you don't believe that there's aluminum in jet fuel, go up on your internet and simply type in Google, jet fuel aluminum. Jet fuel aluminum. You'll find there's aluminum particles in the jet fuel. This is something happened rather recently, and of course it's part and parcel of this program for poisoning the American people. Almost most people today have toxic amounts of aluminum and all the other metals. Our number 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and... Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you listen to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, hopefully, they're going to be the views of our good friend William Grigg. And William first was for many years the senior editor of the New American Magazine. For a time, he was the editor of Republic Magazine. He certainly writes prolifically. You'll find his articles at lewrockwell.com. Of course, you'll find his articles on my website. He writes our monthly newsletter now. It gets to the point where I have a hard time keeping up with all these things. So, fortunately, William writes my monthly newsletter, and we're able, of course, to get it out across the country. And we think he does a wonderful, wonderful job. And basically, of course, William Grigg certainly gives you insight into what's really going on. He's certainly one of the most articulate spokesmen we have for the conservative cause. And we always enjoy having him, and hopefully we'll have him with us here in just a moment. If you're in a position to help William, if you'd like to join his supporters, why, of course, we'll tell you later in the program how you can help him. But William certainly has a family of six and an ill wife. He has a great deal to keep him busy, and yet, of course, he writes prolifically, trying to educate people about what's really going on in the world. And we always look forward to having William with us here on every Friday evening at this time. So we're going to have William back here in just a moment, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Hopefully we'll have William with us shortly. But right now I certainly want to talk about the Boston Marathon bombing. And those of you who, of course, have not gone up on the Internet and put into the search engine Jeff Bauman, a picture in a wheelchair, something like that, and seen those pictures that they have, that they put out on the Internet of Jeff Bauman, whoever he is, that's not his real name, he's an actor, but they have him sitting in a wheelchair. Now, he's just had both legs blown off. He's had both legs blown off. The right leg certainly through the lower thigh, and you can see the remnant of it there. The left leg below the knee, and of course, what you see on the left side is the well-heeled below-knee amputation stump with a piece of bone sticking out of the bottom of it. There's no tear in the flesh. There's not one scratch on the below, well-molded below-knee amputation stump. It's sort of pointed. That's what you do. That's the way you want it to work so they can wear the prosthesis. But of course, wait a minute, now we're told it had his leg blown off. In fact, you can see a piece of tibia, bloody tibia there, sticking out at the very end, without a bit of flesh, without a bit of muscle, without a bit of skin, just a piece of bone sticking out of the end of this stump. And ladies and gentlemen, I was an orthopedic surgeon for, 35, 40 years in my training and my practice. I never saw anything like that. It was obvious this is staged for the impression it's going to have on your mind. Let's go to William Grigg. Hi, William. How are we doing?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing well. It's always a privilege and a blessing to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
What are we going to be talking about this evening?
I think we have to talk about the most recent disclosures about the way the IRS, which is the oldest continuous secret police agency in the world, has been targeting so-called Patriot Tea Party groups. I think that's very significant.
All right. All right, fine. Well, we'll be to that in just a moment. We'll talk about how the IRS is targeting, sending people that they don't like and using the power, the taxing power, as we move opposition, as we move towards the dictatorship in America. William, you go right ahead.
The first thing that has to be recognized, as I said before, is that the IRS is a secret police organization, a political police organization. Its role is that of terrorizing people into complying with the abstruse, self-contradictory tax laws that govern this country that have nothing to do, and this is a very important point as well, with raising revenue for the operating costs of the government. The government, of course, is wedded to the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve can create out of nothing any quantity of so-called money that it chooses. That being the case, you do not need to tax people for revenue. You can simply steal the value of what people earn or save through inflation. So the purposes of the IRS have nothing to do with maintaining sufficient liquidity for the government to operate, certainly not a constitutional government. If you have a constitutional government, you would need perhaps more than a tenth or less of the amount of money spent by the monstrosity in Washington today. It's really interesting. Just a week or so ago, there was a piece in, I believe, the Columbia Journalism Review, one of these major journalism publications, talking about the idea that one victim of the sequester is the IRS because they've been given expansive new responsibilities under the Obamacare law. And, of course, in a time of budget austerity or perceived budget austerity. There's no austerity of any real sort going on. The IRS ups enforcement actions. They've been hiring the last several years as many auditors and enforcement officers as they possibly could. But adjusted for inflation, their budget has not increased to the same extent that many of the bureaucracies have been able to increase their budget. We were invited to lament this as if it were a crisis of some sort. Well, just today, we see confirmation of a story that was actually reported a year ago or longer by an Ohio Fox News affiliate with a very capable investigative reporter by the name of Ben Swan, talking about the fact that the IRS, beginning in Ohio, had been barraging groups that were affiliated with the Tea Party movement or had the word patriot in their name. They've been barraging them with all kinds of invasive, intrusive, harassing questions that have nothing to do with the supposedly legal mandate of the IRS. And the questionnaire that was given to the Ohio Liberty Council is typical of that. It's a very detailed questionnaire, two pages, single-spaced, that is captioned additional information requested. Of course, the IRS is not in the business of requests. They demand, among other things, to know, does your organization promote or publicize itself using any internet social media such as Facebook? If so, list the social media outlets and provide hard copy printouts of those outlets. And that's for
hold that thought. This is Dr. Stan. Well, our guest, of course, is William Gregg, and we're going to be talking about the Internal Revenue Service and how the Internal Revenue Service is being used for political purposes rather than certainly for collecting taxes. In fact, of course, as William points out, the Federal Reserve can create money out of nothing. They don't need to be able to tax the people. I said they can simply create all the money that they need simply through the printing press, and this gets into some economic problems down the line, but why do they want an IRS? Well, they want it so they can monitor and control people and utilize the IRS to actually crush any opposition to the autocratic programs put forward by what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, those people who control both political parties and make mockery of our electoral process. William, you go right ahead.
It's a very good point to connect what the IRS does with this secretive group that you refer to as the Brotherhood of Darkness. This is pretty much a pure product of that covert elite. It's a direct outgrowth of what happened a century ago. And I mentioned that the IRS is the oldest continuous political police, secret police organization in existence. You can actually trace its roots back to the war between the states when you had sort of a proto-IRS that was involved in enforcing the tax laws, the income tax laws that were passed under the reign of Abraham Lincoln. But they got started really at the same time as the Federal Reserve System and the 16th Amendment in 1913. It wasn't until 4 or 5 years later that the Cheka, was founded by Felix Dzerzhinsky, the, I believe, ethnic Polish bank robber who became the head of the Soviet secret police, which became the NKVD, the OGPU, and the KGB, and now the FSB. So the IRS has actually been in existence for longer than the KGB, and quite frankly, they do the same kinds of things as this detailed interrogation of the Ohio Liberty Counsel Corporation illustrates. Once again, some of the questions that were that they were required to answer. How does your organization solicit members? What are the questions asked of potential members? Who? What are the selection criteria for approval? Do you limit membership to other organizations exempt under Section 501c4 of the code? Provide the name, employer identification, and address of the organization. That has nothing to do, of course, with the question of tax status. Provide the following information for all the public events conducted or planned to be conducted by your organization. The time, location, and content schedule of each event. Identify and provide copies of handouts to the audience. Identify workshop materials that instructors will use. The names and credentials of the instructors. If speeches or forums were or will be conducted at the event, provide detailed contents of the speeches or forums, names of the speakers or panels, and their credentials. If any speakers or panel members will be paid, provide the amount that will be paid to each person. If not, please indicate they volunteer to conduct the event. That perhaps is the only question in that section that has anything to do with tax liability. The names of persons from your organization and the amount of time they will spend on the event indicate the name and amount of time they will spend on the event. Indicate the name and amount of compensation that would be paid to each person, etc. It goes on that vein for a couple of questions. Have you conducted or will you conduct candidate forums or other events at which candidates running for public office are invited to speak? If so, provide the following details of the nature of the forum, including the names of candidates, the names of candidates who did participate, those who were invited to participate, the issues that were discussed, the time and location of the event, copies of all handouts, etc., and so forth. Have you attempted or will you attempt to influence the outcome of specific legislation? If so, provide the following. Copies of all communications, pamphlets, advertisements, and other materials distributed by the organization regarding the legislation. Copies of any radio, television, or internet advertisements relating to your lobbying activities. Indicate the percentage of time or resources that you have spent or will spend conducting these activities. Do you directly or indirectly communicate with members of legislative bodies? If so, provide copies of the written communications and contents or other form of communication, and so on and so forth. In another instance, the IRS asked I'm trying to find the specific name of the organization, but asked one organization that was targeted because its name included the phrase Tea Party or Patriot, asked if there were family members of those who belonged to that organization who had considered running for public office. And, of course, if you understand the morphology of a secret police organization, this all makes perfect sense because a secret police organization wants to collect as much information as possible on as many people as possible, acquiring as many details regarding their activities, their qualifications, their background, their potential weaknesses, their vulnerabilities. That's the sort of thing that a political police body does. That's not the sort of thing that tax collectors who are limited to tax collection would do. The sheriff of Nottingham and those whom he had deputized tax farmers in ancient England didn't have to get such detailed information on the people he was shaking down. He simply wanted to know where the money was and how he could get it. That's not the sort of information being obtained through these invasive surveys that were conducted by the IRS. And the other thing that's very interesting, of course, is the reason and way in which these groups were selected. The spokesperson for the IRS who admitted that this, what she described as inappropriate scrutiny, had taken place last year, insisted that there was no targeting of people on the basis of their political affiliation or their political inclination. Unfortunately, in the same press conference, she admitted that these groups had been focused on, another word for describing that type of focus, targeting, because of their names, because they had some combination of red starred or red flag names such as Tea Party or Patriot or Liberty. In other words, they were data mining these groups on the basis of a set of assumptions regarding the sort of people who would use certain phrases or expressions in the names of their organization. If you have the word patriot in the title of your group, chances are the IRS would target you, whether or not they'd use that term later, they'd target you for scrutiny. And this is something, of course, which is not unique to the Obama administration. The IRS, time immemorial, has been used this way, both locally and on the national scene, to target those who are seen as political enemies of a given incumbent administration, or people who are just troublesome in terms of their outlook on the world. It's interesting that one of the bill of particulars, the proposed articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon, he was not impeached, of course. He resigned before he was to be impeached. But one of the articles of impeachment dealt with the accusation that he was misusing the IRS to target his political enemies. So we have Congress on record now as recognizing that the political use of the IRS in this fashion is a high crime against the Constitution. It fits the category of high crimes and misdemeanors that would be suitable for impeachment of a president. That is to say, once again, that it began with Nixon either, of course. LBJ and JFK were very deeply involved in the political use of the IRS against their enemies, against the so-called radical right in particular. But you can go back 70 years to the FDR administration to perhaps find the purest expression of this evil idea that the IRS should be deployed against people who are seen as critics of an incumbent administration. Back in March of 1942, there was a meeting of the Overseas Writers Association, which was a Marxist front group that featured a number of people who were part of FDR's administration. And this meeting dealt with the fact there was still, at this time, after Pearl Harbor and after the beginning of U.S. involvement in World War II, there were many people who were part of what we now call the America First Movement who continued to be critical of FDR and his foreign policy, particularly his chumminess with Stalin's Russia. And they were still opposed to full-blown U.S. involvement in the European War. They recognized that something would have to be done regarding Japan's aggression against Pearl Harbor. They didn't perhaps understand that that aggression was abetted by FDR, that he was a co-conspirator in the attack on Pearl Harbor. But these people resisted FDR's war agenda for militarizing the country, regimenting the economy, getting us involved and immersed in the European conflict on behalf of the Soviet Union. So at this meeting, the Overseas Writers Association, there were many people along the popular front line, if you will, people who were in the FDR administration, who were talking about a number of prominent figures, including Robert McCormick, who published the Chicago Tribune, and Joe Patterson of the New York Daily News, and neither of which, by the way, is any kind of a conservative or libertarian paper anymore. But Francis Biddle, the Attorney General under FDR at the time, had been instructed by FDR to see what he could do about arranging for a sedition trial against people who were seen as enemies of the war effort, which is to say enemies of what the FDR was doing to the country in the name of the war effort. And at this meeting of the Overseas Writers Association, one of the speakers, referring to Robert McCormick, said the following: hang him, shoot him, or lock him up in a concentration camp. Biddle, on the other hand, got notes from FDR that was sort of in the same in the same key, the same flavor. But one of the things that he suggested was that they should stick the IRS on McCormick and other people of that kind, people who were seen as critics of FDR. And so it shouldn't surprise us to see that the IRS and the FBI were both deployed on behalf of FDR during World War II. And you had, I think, 28 writers and activists who were part of what we would have to call now sort of a Stalinist show trial, a sedition trial, because they had publicly opposed the war. And a lot of the information that was gathered on behalf of those groups was compiled by people who were popular front assets of the Soviet Union, but the IRS was involved in compiling information for use in the sedition trial. And, of course, this is the sort of thing I think that is the template for how any dictator, whether you're talking about Obama or a successor, would perhaps in some future setting crack down on people who are enemies of the regime.
Well, let me just point out that, ladies and gentlemen, we're being manipulated into a World War III. It's only a matter of time. It's all being contrived. I mean, who is financing the Muslim Brotherhood? We are. We're just transferring all the countries over there to the Muslim Brotherhood and arming them in preparation for the coming war so the weapons that they have can be used to kill our soldiers. William, you go right ahead.
In time of war, Cicero told us, the laws fall silent. And that's one of the reasons why the founders of this country, the framers of the Constitution, were very leery about warfare, and why you had insightful men such as James Madison say that no country can retain its freedom in the midst of perpetual war. War is the parent of armies, and armies beget debts and taxes. Armies and debts and taxes are their own instruments for bringing the many under the rule of the few. I'm paraphrasing Madison there once again. Armies and debts and taxes. And what we find mortifying about war are precisely those things that make war appealing to people who want to rule over others. And as you say, Dr. Stan, we are being manipulated into a situation that would be, if not World War III, something perilously close to it, something so closely kindred to it that the difference would be negligible. Just today, of course, we heard that the Obama administration is going to be sending $100 million of aid to the so-called Syrian rebels. Of course, this is described as humanitarian aid to deal with the horrific circumstances in Syria where you've got tens of thousands of people who've been killed. But this, of course, is part, I contend, of the gradual rollout of public acknowledgement that the Obama administration has been providing not only non-lethal aid, but lethal aid. They've been arming and tripping and training and equipping and providing battlefield intelligence, and probably on-the-scene support to the worst elements of the so-called Syrian resistance, which include people who were involved in combat against U.S. forces in Iraq, and most likely people who are part of the diaspora of radical Muslims from Libya. They've been overthrowing these countries ruled over by aging and not entirely U.S.-aligned autocrats now, places like Libya and, of course, Iraq. And now Bashar Assad, the hereditary ruler and hereditary dictator of Syria, has been targeted as well. But all this, of course, is creating a tropism toward a regional war, a general war that would be global in scope owing to the alliances that would be entangled in this. And it's worth pointing out as well that at the same time, in not merely the Near East, but in Africa, the drone campaign in places like Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, the drone campaign is turning literally hundreds of millions of people against the United States. Last week we reviewed the fact that Pakistan, which is a country of 180 million people, a Muslim country that has nuclear weapons, now looks upon the United States rather than India as its chief enemy. And that's of some moment because since 1948, Pakistan and India have been in venom blood rivals. They hate each other deeply. They've fought a couple of limited wars in the 1960s. And they've actually come to the point in the late 1960s where, 1970s and early 1980s actually, where both of these countries are very large nuclear armed governments that rule these countries. And they're completely willing to go nuclear if they see this as being in the interests of their foreign policy. Most recently, I think in 1998, they were actually at a point where there was overt talk of a potential nuclear exchange there in the subcontinent between Pakistan and India. So obviously, if the Pakistani population has decided that the United States is the...
Hold that thought, William. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is William Grigg. And basically, he's talking about the fact that certainly Pakistan looks upon the United States as their primary enemy today. Now, traditionally, Pakistan's primary enemy has been India, and they've even were on the verge of a nuclear war with India in the past, that the two countries seem to get along, at least. They tolerate one another. But now America has replaced India as, from the Pakistani point of view, is the major enemy, and certainly Pakistan has a number of nuclear weapons. We won't go into how they got them, because, of course, they got them. They were transferred from the United States, or at least the technology. And certainly that is the information we get from Sybil Edmonds, who, but that's a different story for a different time. Under any circumstances, Pakistan, because of the drone attacks, because we're killing their women and children, ladies and gentlemen, we're killing innocent women and children over there. And the name is, we got to get those wicked, certainly Al-Qaeda and Taliban there. But, ladies and gentlemen, we've been funding Al-Qaeda and Taliban all along. So if we just quit funding Al-Qaeda and Taliban, we wouldn't have to be killing the Pakistani women and children and men. And basically, we've killed literally several thousand innocent civilians. As a result, Pakistan looks upon America, and the Pakistanis look upon America as their primary enemy. Go right ahead.
Yeah, that's, of course, something which is immensely significant on account of the fact that they're neighbors to a large country, much larger country, that they hate to the depths of their soul. They have a deeper-than-marrow-deep hatred for the Indians. But they've come to hate us even more passionately because they are under the constant threat of an airborne assault conducted by robot aircraft that includes double tap strikes to take out first responders. It's perfectly calibrated to turn a country against the United States. The type of people who run this policy are not stupid. Once you've accounted for stupidity and once you've factored for incompetence, stupidity and incompetence, of course, being plentiful in government undertaking, but they can explain only so much. Once you've accounted for those two traits, what you're left with is malicious intent. There has to be an element of malicious intent here in a policy that is pursued so ardently and with such criminal arrogance that you have the spectacle here, the specter rather, of a country of 180 million Muslims becoming an enemy of the United States, a nuclear-armed country of that sort, where it's entirely likely that within the next couple of years, so envenom will become the public mood in Pakistan against the United States that they might actually support some kind of nuclear attack, deniable radiological bomb, suitcase-style nuke against the United States by way of retaliating for drone strikes against that country. Of course, when that happens, the people who have orchestrated this situation here in the United States will seize upon it with giddy eagerness because this is an environment in which they thrive. They do not thrive in the same circumstances that people who are part of the productive sector pursue. They do not thrive in a setting of peace, stability, and prosperity where people are able to mitigate their conflicts through negotiation. And more importantly, they're able to achieve a peaceful modus vivendi through honest and mutually beneficial commerce. That's what we were supposed to be. The original vision of the United States is that we were going to be a decentralized constitutional republic, a confederation, really, of constitutional republics that would have a limited central government with a very modest mandate of providing an environment harmonious, a harmonious environment of domestic tranquility, one conducive to commerce within the extended republic, and, of course, pursuing commercial relations with the rest of the world. That was the vision of Thomas Jefferson, the vision of Madison, and to some limited extent Hamilton, who had other designs, unfortunately. And it's something that the United States managed to live up to with varying levels of fidelity for the first 4 or 5 decades of our existence. But unfortunately now we've metastasized into this pagan empire that is run by people who have the same type of disposition toward dissent that Genghis Khan displayed. Genghis Khan, of course, described himself as the punishing arm of the deity, and he conceived the world in such a way that anybody who dared to resist him by the act of resisting him was iniquitous. And you get that same kind of an attitude on behalf of the epistene paper pushers who run the government, and of course they're the front men for this self-replicating brotherhood of darkness you talk about, Dr. Stan. The IRS is a loathsome instrument. They're making war against us as part of the war they're making upon human decency and liberty everywhere. And I suspect that the war here domestically is going to become very, very grievous to be born just in the next couple of years.
Well, I think we're into some very, very difficult times. The average individual really doesn't want to believe that they're preparing us for a major war over there in the Middle East. but it's only a matter of time. Look and see what's going on, ladies and gentlemen. Put aside your rose-colored glasses and look and see as this whole story is unfolding, and then begin making preparations for yourself and your family. We'll be back in just a moment here.
While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so
William, you go right ahead.
One thing about the IRS that I want to underscore again is the fact that it is not involved in collecting money that's necessary for the operating expense of the government. One of the signal accomplishments of Thomas Jefferson's presidency, and as is the case with every president, of course, including Washington, his presidency was, if you will, a somewhat discord medley of irregular fragments. There were moments of brilliance, and there were moments of something other than brilliance. Of course, most other presidencies have been disastrous, but Thomas Jefferson abolished internal taxes, and he understood that you really cannot have a free society here if the government considers itself entitled to a cut of what people own. If people do not own property, and if people are not permitted to have sanctity in their property, then you do not have liberty. So he abolished the internal collection of taxes. In the January 1946 issue of American Affairs magazine, there was an article written by Beardsley Rummel, who at the time was chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So this is somebody of some prominence within the system that begat this monstrosity called the IRS. Mr. Rummel was the person who helped implement the automatic payroll tax, the withholding system that was inflicted on the United States during World War II. That illustrates, of course, the fact that war is an enabling condition, where you see impositions of the kind that would not be put up with in normal circumstances. Before World War II, no American would consider it to be possible, let alone tolerable, that the government of the United States would be able to steal from their paychecks before they even saw them. Mr. Rummel helped implement that system. He wrote this piece for the January 1946 issue of American Affairs magazine, the title of which is quite significant: Taxes for Revenue Are Obsolete. And the paragraph introduced in this article summarizes the views of Mr. Rummel. His thesis is that given control of a central banking system and an inconvertible currency, that is to say, one not backed by gold, a sovereign national government is finally free of money worries and need no longer levy taxes for the purpose of providing itself with revenue. All taxation, therefore, should be regarded from the point of view of social and economic consequences. What that means, of course, is it the purpose of the tax system, and of course...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Greig, and William simply is pointing out that initially we didn't need taxes, income taxes. Basically, of course, we got our federal government got their money from tariffs, from excise taxes, and then if they needed additional money, they got it from the states, but they did not tax the individual. And basically, of course, William is pointing out that the gentleman who, during the World War II, established the concept of the payroll withholding taxes. Of course, we sold that. Oh, we've got to fight those terrible Germans. And, of course, we were funding the Germans all the time, American banks, American corporations. All during the Second World War, 100 American corporations built the weapons over in Germany that were used to kill our boys. 10 American banks, including Brown Brothers Harriman, headed by Prescott Bush and a man named George Herbert Walker, for whom George Herbert Walker Bush was later named. Those people on the board of directors of Brown Brothers Harriman, one of the major banks, of course, funding the Germans during the World War, the Second World War, when they were killing our boys. So basically people don't understand really what's going on today. World War II was a phony war. Well, we killed about 400,000 American boys, about 60 million people altogether. But it was simply, it was an important thing because we had to get a world government. We had to bring in the United Nations and bring about a world government so we could have peace. So we fought a terrible and horrible and bloody war so we could bring about world peace. And it didn't happen, though. We didn't have a world government. That's why we have to have another world war. We have to have World War III if we're ever going to bring about this world government, and so we can have world peace. But William is certainly pointing out the fact that it was during World War II that they began the withholding tax from people's salaries. And, of course, the whole idea is, the government needs the money to fight the war, to protect us from the terrible Germans and from the terrible Japanese, who, incidentally, we had funded before the Second World War as well. But anyway, and incidentally, the Emperor of Japan was a member of the Order of the Garter, a secret club of all the rulers of the world. He had to drop out of the Order of the Garter during the Second World War. He immediately rejoined it after the Second World War. And Emperor Hirohito was never punished for the part that he played in promoting that war, certainly. And yet he was as guilty as anyone there, any one of the war criminals. But, of course, he was part of the secret societies, so we couldn't very well punish him, could we? The Order of the Garter, ladies and gentlemen, you can look it up. It's not imaginary. There really are secret societies out there that have a different view of the world and are being utilized to bring about what I call the one world government. Well, anyway, William, you were just going ahead and telling us a little bit about this gentleman who was instrumental in bringing the payroll deduction taxes to America during World War II. But he had readily admitted that this was not about raising money. Why don't you go ahead and give those quotations?
We're talking about Beardsley Rummel, who in 1946 was the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. As you mentioned, Dr. Stan, he's one of the people who implemented the withholding tax, payroll withholding tax. And in this article entitled Taxes for Revenue Are Obsolete, he pointed out that when the government has a central bank that can emit inflated currency, it doesn't need to collect revenue through taxes. And so all taxation, as the editorial summary of this article pointed out, should be regarded from the point of view of social and economic consequence. In other words, it's all a matter of social engineering. The tax code is not intended to raise revenue. It's intended to manipulate public economic behavior and individual economic behavior. The purpose of the IRS is not to raise money for the government. It is to terrorize people into behaving in ways that the federal government would ordain, which is why it should surprise us not at all to see that in recent years, under the Obama administration, the IRS has focused its attention on Tea Party groups and Patriot groups and Liberty groups, just in the same way that you saw similar abuses of people who were regarded as domestic political rivals by the Nixon administration, and that was a line in the Bill of Particulars that would have been used in articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon, and Richard Nixon was emulating the behavior of LBJ and JFK and FDR. This is why there is a tax code. This is why there is an Internal Revenue Service. And these people who are part of the IRS see themselves as being at war with the rest of us. That is not a sample of rhetorical hyperbole. There's an immensely useful book by a former IRS revenue agent, revenue collection specialist, who calls himself Richard Yancey. That's a pseudonym. The book was published by a New York publishing house, which means that we're not dealing, of course, with something that was mimeographed or self-published by a fantasist or somebody who's merely a malcontent. This is something that was vetted by people who were in, if you will, the secular publishing world, Confessions of a Tax Collector. And what he recalls is that at one of the first meetings he attended, and in his brief and extremely unpleasant tenure with the IRS, one of the supervisors said, if it were up to me, I'd line them up against the wall and shoot them. And one of the things that he was constantly told by a supervisor is, this is war. Surely this simple truth has occurred to you at some point in the last 6 months. You are at war. Yancey goes on to say, the language of war and the culture of conflict are the only means to prepare us for what is expected of us. How else could they, meaning those who were at the top of the IRS criminal hierarchy demand what was expected of us. You can't take taxpayers' life savings, their car, their paycheck, the roof over their head, and the heads of their children without dehumanizing them, without casting yourself in the role that by necessity makes them the enemy. Those who were educated in the training classes, the training academies for the IRS, if you will, sort of the madrasas of this state terrorist organization, are required to dehumanize the taxpayers that they are sent forth to persecute. And they're also taught to believe that the state, the agency that they serve, is never wrong. And this is something that was recorded by Yancey in the book as well. He recalls an occasion when he and other trainees were told that the IRS had, and I'm quoting now from this book, no use for agents who anguished over each closure as if the decision meant life or death for the taxpayer, which of course frequently does. If you're taking money from somebody, you're stealing a portion of that person's life. If you assume that the government has the moral and legal right to take money that you have earned, to take your property, you do not believe that the person from whom you're taking that property, the product of his own labors, truly owns himself. In other words, you're pursuing a vision of the world that is very closely akin to that that motivated people who believed in and practiced chattel slavery, which was based on the denial of self-ownership. Chattel slavery and the income tax are very close kindred. They're siblings. The only difference between chattel slavery and the income tax is that chattel slavery is a 100% tax, whereas the income tax is a portion of the tax on that person and his property and the means of his production. Now, Yancey and his associates were told the IRS didn't have any use for people who retained some residue of a conscience when they were extracting wealth from the innocent. When one trainee at this session objected that often this literally is the case, that it's a matter of life and death for taxpayers, the trainer replied that the agency's role had nothing at all to do with, quote, doing the right thing for the taxpayer. It was simply that of protecting the government's interest. But what if the government's interest is wrong, objected the trainee. Our interest is never wrong or right, responded the trainer. It just is. This is, of course, severe positivism. That which is right. That which power ordains is self-ratified by virtue of being that which power ordains. Now, there's a former chief, district chief in the IRS by the name of David Patno, who has admitted, I believe in hearings that were held in 1997, you'll have occasional hearings by Congress where the IRS will send forth a few functionaries to talk about making the agency more customer-friendly. Boy, you want to talk about an oxymoron. The IRS treats us as if we were customers. No, referring to us as customers of the IRS is exactly like a rapist referring to his victim as a date. It's obscenity of that order of magnitude. But former IRS District Chief David Patno admitted the following: more taxes collected by fear and intimidation than by the law. What he's describing, once again, is state terrorism. And that's the sort of thing that we see in these disclosures about what the IRS is doing with the Tea Party and Patriot groups over the last couple of years. To which Mr. Yancey, in supplementing what David Patno said about fear and intimidation, to which he adds the following: no one likes to hear this, but your neighbor is not your friend. All I had to do, as an IRS investigator, was to flash my commission and have your life story. Your neighbor is going to tell the IRS where you work, what kind of car you drive, what kind of jewelry you wear, and so on. Not content with merely compiling a financial profile of those targeted, IRS investigators will squeeze from neighbors and associates whatever potentially compromising details they can find regarding the target of an investigation. Does he drink a little too much? Is he seeing a psychologist? Has she had an abortion? Is he faking a disability? We'll know. And most of the time, we won't even have to ask. Having said that, let me go once again to this questionnaire that was handed out to the Ohio Liberty Council when the Ohio Liberty Council was applying for tax-exempt status. These details have nothing to do with the payment of taxes or the management of revenue. They have everything to do with compiling information of the sort that can be used against those who are members of the organization. And this, of course, would be used not only against them, but would be used as leverage to get them to act as informants against other people. And that, again, is how secret police agencies operate. They want to turn people into informants. They want to turn them into assets of the state in order to create more and broader ways of implicating people in what the state would consider to be criminal behavior. Usually it's not a crime. You're usually not dealing with offenses against persons and property, but you're dealing with things that can be prosecuted as if they were offenses. And what the IRS can't obtain from human sources, they will obtain through data mining. They have had for decades a system called the Integrated Data Retrieval System, a proprietary database run by the IRS. And through the IDRS, according to Mr. Yancey, he could learn almost instantly more about taxpayers than they know themselves. One of the interesting things about this is that this was describing what happened in the early 1990s, 20 years ago, which is like the Pleistocene era when you're talking about information storage and retrieval and database operations today. Just within the last few days, there have been stories in the press describing how the IRS is now developing the means to track in real time almost any electronic transaction the people are involved in, almost anywhere in the world, whether you're talking about buying things online or anything that would involve the use of credit cards or debit cards at the major retail stores. And particularly when you're talking about online transactions, the IRS has covertly developed means of using tracking cookies of incredible sophistication in order to follow people and keep an eye on their economic behavior in order to develop this type of a profile that would go into these vast databases that Mr. Yancey was describing. And through these databases, according to Yancey, they'll be able to track everything that you do. One of the other things that I find interesting about the mindset of the IRS is that they assume right from the beginning that everybody is a lawbreaker. And if you assume that the tax code, this vast and abstruse collection of mutually contradictory provisions that is Talmudic in its depth and complexity, if you assume that this is the law, then I suppose everybody is a lawbreaker, because it's impossible to have an objectively perfect tax return, no matter how scrupulous you are about filling out your tax, no matter how honest you are about accounting for your economic activity. If they want to, they can find something wrong with any tax return that is filed, that is submitted for them. All these things, of course, are submitted under the penalty of perjury by people who consider themselves to be entirely unaccountable to us.
Well, but William, before we go on, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website, how they can get to your writings, or how they can get to your PayPal button, because we're coming to the end of this program. So why don't you tell people how they can get in touch with you and get your material?
I really appreciate that, Dr. Stan. My chief outlet is still the Pro Libertate blog. Go to Google or another search engine, type in Pro Libertate, ProLibertate, and the last name, Grigg. Or just type in William N. Grigg, and Pro Libertate should be the first return. The direct address is freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And I've been publishing about once every week over the last little while. I try to publish a little more frequently than that. The reason why I've been publishing on a schedule that's a little less demanding is because I've been undergoing some treatments for a health emergency that emerged a couple of weeks ago. And I'm on the mend right now. Things are getting better. I'm getting back to work and tucking into my daily labors a little more zestfully than I was about a week ago. So that's all good. But that having been said, I have to explain that my productivity has fallen off because I've spent a lot of time flat on my back with one leg propped up in the air or with an IV needle in my arm. And that's not conducive to productivity. But Pro Libertate, the blog, is my chief outlet. At the bottom of every essay you mentioned, Dr. Stan, there is a PayPal button for those who want to donate and have the means to do so, have a PayPal account. I'm going to start publishing a post office box address fairly soon, because a lot of people have said that they don't like PayPal, or they're not part of PayPal. They've expressed an interest in donating. And we are, my family and I, my wife Corinne and our children, extremely grateful for all the help that we receive. Everything that is provided to us by way of a donation. Literally a gift of life. This is It's how I provide for my family. And it's been tremendously heartening to see that in the last 2 weeks, as I've been dealing with some really severe and unexpected medical expenses, the people have been exceptionally generous toward me and toward my family.
And I certainly appreciate that. Certainly Barbara and I support William. We think he does a wonderful job. He's certainly one of the most outstanding writers out there. One of the better minds that we have, certainly trying to help us understand what's going on today. And I will tell you that I was the one who insisted on William actually putting up that PayPal button. He didn't want to do that. He didn't want to ask people for help. And I had to bug him for about a month and a half to 2 months before he finally got the PayPal button up. And I'm glad now he's going to have certainly a post office box as well. But if you're out there in a position to help William and his family, why, it's well worthwhile. Because he certainly is on the front lines of this battle. There's just a small number of people out there putting their time in full time, trying to get people to understand what freedom is about. And of course, what will happen when freedom is lost. But freedom is not free. If we aren't involved in getting the information out, if we don't let people understand that there really are those who have a different worldview and they want to use America's financial and military power to bring about a one world government. And they've taken us from war to war, from crisis to crisis, from incident to incident, and most of these incidents are totally manufactured. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we're on the brink of another war. And I've been following this for some time. It's only not a matter of if, but when, of course, the war over there in the Middle East, Syria, Iran, all of this explodes into something and will have a profound impact, ladies and gentlemen, on you here in America as well. William, go right ahead.
Dr. Stan, it's always a blessing and a pleasure to be on your program, in spite of the fact that we find ourselves necessarily immersed in such robustly unpleasant subjects. One of the things that I've been pondering over the last few days and discussing with some of my close friends here in Idaho is the futility of trying to pretend that we can somehow avoid the conflict that is thrust upon us, that we can somehow, by making ourselves inconspicuous, avoid being harassed or intimidated or persecuted by people that sort of we describe. And one of the really potent lessons taught by the scandal involving the IRS is that if you are involved in the struggle, you can expect that there will be efforts to intimidate you and immiserate you, impoverish you, incarcerate you, or otherwise ruin your life. That's something that the patriots of every generation have experienced. That was certainly the case with brave men who signed the Declaration of Independence. And we really shouldn't flatter ourselves by thinking that we would be treated any more gently than they were, because the government against which they arrayed themselves, loathsome though it was immeasurably less invasive than the one that we confront today in Washington, and the one that is being gestated in the corridors of power that would span the world and claim the entire globe as its jurisdiction. And one of the things that we have to recognize, I hate to quote in any sense that could be regarded as favorable Leon Trotsky, but Leon Trotsky, of course, the founder of the Red Army and one of the founding fathers of the Soviet Union, one of the most evil figures in history, had a certain point when he said that you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. And these are people like Trotsky and unfortunately his disciples, they're scattered. Certain generosity on both sides of the artificial political spectrum here. People like that are making war on us. That's something that we have to recognize. They're not always going to be using, of course, serried rows of paramilitary enforcers or helicopters or drones to prosecute that war. Sometimes the people that prosecute that war are going to be people in business suits and computers. But they are making war on us. That's a reality we can't avoid, and we don't have the luxury of pretending as if it is so.
I agree with you, and I fear that things are going to get a lot worse in the coming weeks and months. I don't know how soon this war is going to break out in the Middle East, maybe a matter of months, maybe a matter of years. We're just going to have to wait and see, but there is a timetable. They know exactly what they're doing, and so Syria and certainly the other countries there, Iran, I really fear we're in for some very bad times. Good night, William. God bless. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Deborah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We do hope you enjoy our conversations weekly with William Grigg, certainly one of my favorite guests. And now this is the time when I need to remind our listeners out across America that my ministry, Radio Liberties, primarily listener-supported, and as you know, we have over 50 outlets every single week, and we've got to finance them, and of course we have radio stations, and we have shortwave, and we have internet, and we have satellite, and all of these things are expensive, and believe me, we have all sorts of various means by which our program's getting out there, and quite frankly, we need your help to continue doing what we're doing. So if you're in a position to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, or certainly to buy some of the products that we have, and that always helps. And we have the books, and we have certainly the DVD sets, and we have DVDs, and we have CD sets, and we have tape sets. And anyway, if you're in a position to get them, they will help us, and anything we produced, you have our permission to get and circulate. And then, of course, we carry a number of other products. We carry health products, and I would recommend them to you. I really believe you need the health supplements, and if you'd like a list, just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We've recently taken on providing spices, and people say, why would you provide spices? Well, because basically they will make your meals much more enjoyable, and besides that, they will help to fund Radio Liberty. And we've used these for ourselves for a long period of time, and so we're glad to offer them to you. We carry the Miracle 2 soap products, and I wouldn't be without the Miracle 2 the gel. I put that on my hair. I have for years. My wife, well, I won't tell you how old she was, but she looks 20 years younger than her real age. And she uses the Miracle 2 soap products. And then, of course, we have the Berkey products. And you need to have a Berkey water filter. You need to begin making your preparations to be sure you're always going to be able to have water that you as drinkable. Because we're heading into a crisis situation, ladies and gentlemen, and it's only a matter of time. It's not a matter of if, but when this comes, because I believe God is going to bring his judgment on America. And your job is to be able to protect yourself and your family, and you're probably not going to be able to rely upon municipal resources. I hope I'm wrong, but just in case I'm right, begin making your plans and consider getting not only a Berkey water filter of one sort or another, but get extra filters to have them on hand, and get extra products, get food and other supplies that you would need in case you went to the store and there was nothing there. If you haven't gotten our DVDs on the threat of an EMP attack, you need to get it. That's an electromagnetic pack, a pulse attack, and if you don't know what it is, it's because you're not supposed to, but basically, either exploding a nuclear bomb 300 miles above Omaha, Nebraska, or based upon a solar flare, they could wipe out instantaneously our entire electronic grid, and we have no protection at all. It could happen this evening. It could happen a week from now. But I will tell you, you need to get this DVD on the threat of an EMP attack. You need to get the 4-CD set. You need to get the Congressional Commission report from 2004. It's about 100 pages. It's the threat of an EMP attack. And then, of course, you need to get the book, A Nation Forsaken, by Michael Maloof, who was 30 years in the Defense Department. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. Radioliberty.com, where you can watch our DVDs, where you can read our newsletters, where you can listen to our radio programs. And as you know, we do 5 hours of radio a day. You can listen 4 hours live at our website at radioliberty.com, or certainly you can get the archive programs. But the programs are available on shortwave. They're available on telephone, the afternoon program. We have people who listen to 2 hours of the afternoon. And certainly, if you have a KU satellite, why? Because you can pull our programs down. Please encourage others to listen. And then encourage them to certainly get the information out. We ask you to pray for America, but please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision, and our protection. To a land that's free.
Radio show. So glad to have you join us today. It is Feel Good Friday. Make sure that you do feel good on Friday, even though the rest of the world is going, whoa, man, there's a problem with the IRS. Oh, you just noticed, huh? You didn't notice since the 1950s they have been targeting people, killing people, extorting people with the IRS? I've yet to hear someone say, yet, do you think it's time we reevaluate the IRS? I've yet to hear all of these anchors on TV impressed with their makeup and hair jobs say, do you think it's time? Perhaps there's enough corruption now. I can't believe it. Joining me is Josh in the studio today. Thank you, Josh, for being here.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yes, and we are going to have some IRS humor in the second hour. It seems like that's a juxtaposition, don't you think? It is doesn't make any sense, IRS humor. I think we will in the second hour. And all you have to do is read some of the stories, and that gives you enough humor right